Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, who talks about what's at stake in the Supreme Court ruling, determining whether or not a citizenship question is included in the 2020 census. Andres Bernal, an advisor to New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who discusses how the various elements of the proposed Green New Deal legislation came together. And Andrew Coburn, journalist, author, and Washington editor with Harper's Magazine, who takes a critical look at Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden's legislative record. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On the eve of the 21st anniversary of the Good Friday Peace Agreement, Northern Ireland journalist Lyra McKee was killed by a sniper's bullet during a police confrontation with a dissident Republican protest in Derry. The shooting occurred in the Creggan housing estate, one of the poorest places in the United Kingdom and a hotbed of dissident Republican activists who reject peace with British authorities. The murder of McKee, a respected 29-year-old journalist and LGBT activist, shocked the UK. The new IRA took responsibility and apologised for McKee's death. On the night of the shooting, McKee, who writes about the plight of Northern Irish youth, stood near a police vehicle when a masked sniper shot into the crowd. The new IRA was formed between 2011 and 2012, following the merger of smaller groups opposed to the IRA and Sinn Féin's embrace of the late 1990s peace process. Derry, the second largest city in Northern Ireland, never benefited from the predicted economic boost after the 1998 Good Friday peace agreement. In contrast, Belfast and its suburbs boomed when new tech companies moved in offering good-paying jobs. According to a recent survey, 95% of youth in Derry see no future in their city. The killing of McKee has united opposing political parties, the Democratic Unionists and Sinn Féin, who agreed to restart deadlocked power-sharing talks in early May. In the midst of rising anti-immigrant populism across Europe, the German Green Party is seeing a boost in its popularity in opposition to the far-right Alternative for Germany movement. The Green Party is now the second most popular party in Germany in the months before critical state elections. In the past, the Greens served as a junior partner in centre-left social democratic governments and are now part of governing coalitions in 9 of Germany's 16 states. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the Greens' environmental focus resonates with the German middle class that has embraced green mainstays such as organic farming, bicycling and recycling. More important, it is the only German party whose pro-European, refugee-friendly, liberal-democratic credentials are undisputed. A political test for the Greens will come in September, when they compete in state elections in the former East Germany, where the party has struggled in the past and will face opposition from far-right forces. To gain the initiative, the Greens plan to mobilise the youth vote and stake out a clear position in favour of the European Union. In his early days on the El Paso City Council, one of today's aspiring Democratic presidential candidates, Beto O'Rourke, backed a controversial redevelopment plan that would have displaced 2,000 poor residents to build a sports arena and stores in the city's historic south side. The plan was fiercely opposed by the community's poor Latino residents, many of whom were O'Rourke's constituents, and today much of the community is roped off and derelict after the stadium construction project was stalled after being challenged in court. O'Rourke's father-in-law, Bill Sanders, one of the richest and most powerful men in El Paso, led the consortium of white business owners in the city and investors from Juarez across the border looking to cash in on economic development tied to the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Many community activists in El Paso felt betrayed by O'Rourke's support for the redevelopment plan and his family ties to the developers. Later, in 2012, O'Rourke used his father-in-law's business connections to raise the funds needed to defeat incumbent Democratic Congressman Sylvester Reyes. In the primary election, Beto ran to Ray's left on legalising marijuana and to his right in support of increasing the Social Security retirement age. As the American Prospect framed it, in the end, O'Rourke fought for the redevelopment plan and the redevelopers fought for him. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Since 2017, the Trump administration has been pushing to include a question on citizenship in the 2020 U.S. Census. But groups that launched lawsuits opposing the move assert that inclusion of the question would discourage many undocumented immigrants and their families from participating in the census, which would result in a population undercount nationwide, estimated to total between 4 and 6 million. Areas with large immigrant communities would bear the brunt of the predicted undercount. The census, mandated by the U.S. Constitution, calls for an accurate count of the entire population every 10 years, without regard to citizenship status. Critically, the census numbers are used to determine both the allocation of seats in the House of Representatives and the distribution of some $883 billion in federal funding received by cities and states. The idea to include the citizenship question was first introduced by former White House strategist Steve Bannon, who suggested that Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross discuss the issue with then-Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach, a national advocate of measures to suppress the vote of minority communities. After three federal judges blocked the citizenship question from being part of the 2020 census, the case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which heard arguments on April 23rd. Your reporter spoke with Kristen Clark, president and executive director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Here she talks about what's at stake in the high court's ruling on the census question and assesses the consequences for political representation and state and local budgets.
A citizenship question has not appeared on the census since the Jim Crow era. So in more than six decades, the government hasn't done this. And they haven't done it because the government realized that we need a short-form census to really encourage maximum participation by the public. So the census is very short. The form that goes out to every household is very short, and it's really designed, again, on capturing that accurate count. At the 11th hour, this administration move to add the citizenship question. And we know that this is all about discouraging participation among certain communities, and in particular among communities of color, among immigrant communities, among households that have a mix of citizens and non-citizens living within them. We know that all of this comes at a time when this administration really has demonstrated hostility towards immigrant groups. So this was quite remarkable because the Census Bureau's own scientists said, don't do this. The evidence and data makes clear that this will depress participation and yield a far less accurate census than we would get otherwise. The administration, on the other hand, said, no, we're doing this because we want to give the Justice Department the data and information that they need to enforce the Voting Rights Act. We know that that justification is false and borderline laughable, given that this administration has not filed a single Voting Rights Act case. But moreover, since the Voting Rights Act has been passed, we've been able to bring cases successfully without citizenship data captured by the census. So the justification for why the administration is doing this is false. And what we're hoping is that the Supreme Court will pull the veil and look behind this effort and see it for what it is. This is an 11th hour attempt to hijack the census and discourage people of color from raising their hand and being counted.
You were present in the Supreme Court while the hearings over the citizenship question were conducted. Tell us about your impressions of the breakdown of justices and where you think they stand. I know we won't know for sure until there is a ruling on this case, but there are other observers who found that the conservative majority on the court looked through their questioning as if they were very sympathetic to allowing the inclusion of the citizenship question in the census next year.
One thing that I was quite struck by was Justice Kavanaugh, followed by Justice Gorsuch, who looked at what some other countries do. They looked and pointed to the practices of Spain and Germany and other places that may indeed count the citizen, you know, consider citizenship in their census. But one of the oralists, Solicitor General Barbara Underwood of New York, very aptly pointed out that she does not know what those constitutions require. She does not know if they contain an enumeration clause like ours that requires a complete and accurate count. And she also doesn't know the facts in those countries and whether or not the citizenship question produces an undercount in the way that we know it would here. I wonder if this means that we'll see a Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch who care about international and human rights standards and will be looking for guidance from other countries on how they approach issues like this. I suspect that that's not the case, and to me seem to show the justices really stretching and willing to go far beyond the evidence before the court in this case to arrive at the outcome that they want, which may likely be one in which they're inclined to defer to Wilbur Ross's action here and leave the citizenship question in place. For the court to ignore all of the evidence before it and arrive at an outcome where they leave that question in place, I think could leave many people feeling that the Supreme Court has become a body that is just about helping carry out and execute the Trump agenda. And we don't want that. We want a judicial branch that can be fair and independent in looking the facts that come before it in each and every case and issue rulings that comply and show faith with the Constitution and the laws that come before it and that can garner the confidence of the public.
That was Kristen Clark, President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Learn more about what's at stake in the Supreme Court's ruling on the census citizenship question by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The proposed Green New Deal legislation has raised the visibility of the planet's climate crisis, sparking a spirited debate among many of the nation's politicians, both for and against the measure. Polls find that the legislation garners wide support among Americans across the political spectrum if its proposals aren't identified solely with the Democratic Party. The Green New Deal calls for the U.S. to become carbon neutral by the year 2030 and addresses income inequality by including guaranteed universal health care and a job for anyone who wants one. Jobs would be created in the sustainable renewable energy sector and provide support for fossil fuel workers to transition to other good-paying jobs. Many other jobs would be created in childcare, senior care, assisting the ill and disabled, and sustainable employment in the arts. The guaranteed jobs component was proposed to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez by Andres Bernal, a lecturer in urban studies at Queens College, who serves as an advisor to the Congresswoman. The proposal was included in the non-binding resolution introduced in the House by Ocasio-Cortez and in the Senate by Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. The youth-led Sunrise Movement has been promoting the Green New Deal for months and is now in the midst of a nationwide campaign tour. Bernal spoke about the Green New Deal and how the various pieces came together in a talk he gave at Yale University on April 29th.
Alexandria was already talking about mobilizing as if we were going to war, but rather than going out to, you know, kill people, we were going to save ourselves from this disastrous situation that we had put ourselves into. And that was getting really, really popular. People were really responding to this. It wasn't a campaign that was necessarily committed to an orthodox ideology or anything like that. Oftentimes she would say that this isn't necessarily about left and right, this is about top versus bottom. And that really resonated with people in the community who weren't necessarily informed or educated on politics and that sort of thing. So it was an incredible grassroots movement. She did an amazing job, but also it was a testament to the people around her that in the people in the community that did an amazing job as well. So she pulled that off. And as she won the primary, I started to get more involved in, like, okay, what kind of things can we actually continue to propose and offer? And at that time, something that I had become very interested in, which I started to learn about after the Bernie Sanders primary and the 2016 election and that whole kind of fiasco, was that I thought that we needed to reinvigorate our public imaginations, because there was something that was missing from what we thought was possible. And that's when I learned about this idea called the Federal Jobs Guarantee. The more I started to learn about this idea, the more I started to realize that there's a lot of work that needs to be done that isn't the same as, you know, your typical office job or something like that, but it's in communities. It's rebuilding communities. It's reconnecting, reestablishing trust, education, tutoring, childcare, caring for one another, creating urban gardens, restoring ecologies and communities, things like that. And I got really, really interested in that. And so at one meeting with Alexandria, I said to her, hey, you should check out this idea. And I really, really think it would be good for your entire vision. So she came with me to a conference where Pavlina actually spoke at and ended up putting the Jobs Guarantee on her platform. The Jobs Guarantee ended up being the most popular policy on her platform. At, you know, the moment she put it on, it became more popular than Medicare for All. So that's kind of like the role that I had, as well as having different conversations about breaking away from certain orthodoxies that many on the center-left and left have been trapped in, particularly around fiscal policy and how, you know, our government actually works and pays for things. Because we seem to be trapped in this idea that is inherently a very conservative idea, that our federal government that has a total monopoly over the U.S. dollar needs to find revenue from places in order to do anything. And so we're kind of trapped thinking about, well, how much do we have to tax where, and where do we lower money where, and everything is like dollar for dollar. Environmental policy in the United States, since the 1970s, in that era, has kind of really been about regulating an economy that is inherently toxic, that inherently produces all kinds of externalities and negative things, and try to make it as livable as possible, perhaps, through regulations and whatnot, but never really kind of a bold agenda that understands that with technology and with individual consumption alone, we're not going to be able to address the real issues that are at the core of a fossil fuel extractive capitalist economy. So we want to accomplish this by creating millions of jobs to build out an entire infrastructure of what a renewable economy would need. Everything from high-speed rail to the kind of solar, wind, geothermal, hydroelectric, all these other kind of ways of building energy, ways of storing energy. And in order to do that, we have to start to center the conversation around this idea of political ecology, which is to say that our entire economy and social ecosystem is connected, and it's part of nature too. It is not disconnected. And so that for me represents this bigger initiative to, and Alexandria likes to talk about this too, to kind of rediscover the public imagination. What can we think is possible? What can we do? Where should our agenda be? So we want to make sure that this transition to a different kind of ecosystem and economy also has justice at the forefront.
That was Andres Bernal, a lecturer in urban studies at Queens College, who serves as an advisor to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Learn more about the proposed Green New Deal by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Former Vice President Joe Biden launched his 2020 presidential candidacy with the release of a video on April 25th in which the former senator from Delaware declared that there's a battle for the soul of this nation. The video announcement focused on the 2017 white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in which counter-protester Heather Heyer was killed, and President Trump's later assertion that there were very fine people on both sides. Since his announcement, corporate media has focused much attention on criticism leveled at Biden for his conduct as Judiciary Committee chair during the testimony of Anita Hill, part of Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas's controversial 1991 confirmation hearings. Before the official launch of his candidacy, Biden also came under attack for allegations that he had a habit of improperly invading the personal space of women. In March, while at a Democratic fundraising dinner in Delaware, Biden declared that he would be the most progressive candidate in the presidential race. But Biden, who spent 36 years in the U.S. Senate and 8 years as Barack Obama's vice president, has amassed a long legislative record that, when examined, provides insight into his politics, policy priorities, and his relationships with corporate America. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Coburn, journalist, author, and Washington editor at Harper's Magazine, who explains why he believes that Joe Biden is anything but progressive, as set forth in his article titled, "No Joe, Joe Biden's Disastrous Legislative Legacy."
In my Harper's piece, I really went back to the 1970s, soon after he got into the Senate, you know, as then a very young senator. One of the sort of, you know, big issues of the day was school busing, and an effort by the federal government and the federal courts to bring about school integration, which was being resisted not just in the South but in the North by moving children around. Since, you know, we are so residentially segregated in this country, certainly then and as indeed now, the idea was to bus children from, you know, white districts to black districts and vice versa. And Joe really came out very strongly and sort of vociferously against that. He made it his signature issue, really, in the 1970s. And he actually sponsored legislation that really weakened it, prevented the federal government from expending funds to assist school busing, which the then lone African-American senator, and I think he was the first one since Reconstruction, Ed Brooke of Massachusetts, called it the greatest setback to civil rights since the 1964 Voting Rights Act. So, and he went on from there, in the 1980s, among other iniquities, he really championed this whole tough-on-crime approach, which was the effort of the, you know, the sort of corporate wing of the Democratic Party to really to win the ever-elusive Republican swing voter by instituting ever harsher crackdowns, really, on black people, with, you know, among other things, a notorious distinction between powder cocaine and crack cocaine. I think it was disparity was 100 to 1 in terms of sentences. You know, white people used powder cocaine, and they got, comparatively speaking, light sentences. Thanks to Joe's legislation, black people with crack cocaine got very heavy sentences, thanks to Joe.
Andrew, you also go into some history of Joe Biden as it affects banking regulation. Critically important to what happened in 2008 with the economic meltdown here in the U.S. and around the world. There was a bill called the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act of 1999 that Joe Biden played a role in. Review for our listeners what Joe Biden did in terms of deregulating the banks and repealing the Glass-Steagall Act.
Right. Well, that act you just referred to, Graham-Leach-Bliley, was the repeal of Glass-Steagall. And just to remind people, Glass-Steagall was a Depression-era a New Deal era, really, piece of legislation that separated investment banks from commercial banks. It meant, what it really meant was that banks couldn't gamble with your money and mine, so that, you know, that our money in the bank is protected by the, you know, is insured under the, thanks to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And Glass-Steagall meant that they couldn't then go off and take our money and sort of make bets with it, which had been going on in the run-up to the Great Crash. And there was a steady, remorseless effort by the banks to get that repealed, especially in the 1990s. And finally, in 1999, they succeeded, and with the Gramm-Leach-Bliley, and Joe Biden voted for that. In fact, he was an active proponent of that, although he was not alone there. I mean, the Clinton administration was all for it. I mean, it was the very, very unfortunate period when the Democratic administration, and indeed everyone, I mean, it was a very bipartisan consensus that, you know, that Wall Street should be freed from regulation to do whatever they felt like, which was what they felt like, was, of course, we found out in 2008, was the, you know, the near collapse of the global economy.
From what we know about the record you've researched, Andrew, what's your feeling about Joe Biden and how he's pitching his campaign as being a progressive guy?
Pretty upsetting, you know, because he's not a progressive guy. I mean, nothing in his record suggests he's a progressive guy. In fact, pretty much everything in his record suggests he's not a progressive guy. It's the usual story of the Democratic Party, you know, like Obama ran as a populist and really, you know, and made all sorts of progressive noises. And his appointment was basically a Citigroup administration stuffed with people from Wall Street. And I wouldn't look for too much different in a Biden administration.
That was Andrew Coburn, journalist, author, and Washington editor at Harper's Magazine. Find a link to his recent Harper's article titled No Joe, Joe Biden's Disastrous Legislative Legacy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBSU in Brockport, New York, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.